I'm Nate Silver, and this...
No, we gotta start over. You definitely blew out the microphone. A little bit softer. Hello, and welcome to the 538 Politics Podcast. I'm Galen Druk.
I'm Nate Silver.
And this is Model Talk.
A little bit subdued, because Galen was worried about me blowing out my microphone with too much enthusiasm, number one. And secondly, it's not technically a model, although we're finicky about how we describe models. It's kind of polling average talk.
Yeah. Okay. So yeah. This is officially polling average talk. But for the sake of memories, do you remember the last time we recorded a model talk, Nate?
Well, we talked to the coronavirus modeler. Was that branded Model Talk?
Oh, that's true. But the last time we did a politics model talk was at the Sloan Sports Analytics Conference in Boston at the beginning of March, the week before we were put into quarantine. Feels like a lifetime ago.
I am a huge fan of that conference and the people at the conference and who run the conference. In retrospect, I think the risk of COVID transmission was non-zero at that conference. But
We found out afterwards that there was somebody who attended the conference who had COVID.
We don't have to get into it, but yeah, that was good old times.
Yeah. Anyway, as you said, this is a model talk of sorts. We have not published our 2020 forecast model, but today we officially published polling averages for both the country as a whole and individual states. And so, unlike the forecast model, which is trying to predict the outcome on election day, what we're going to talk about today, these averages are a snapshot of what the race looks like in this moment. And so, without further ado, let's get to the actual averages. Nationally, Biden is leading Trump by 9 percentage points, about 50% to 41%. That's not the likelihood of Biden winning. That is the percent of Americans who support those two candidates currently. And then also, just to list some battleground states, Biden is leading Trump by between 5 and 7 points in Wisconsin, Pennsylvania, Florida, and Minnesota. He leads Trump by 4 points in Arizona and then 10 points in Michigan. And we'll get into what all of those numbers mean. But to start things off, Nate, when we've talked about the state of the race in the past, you said that you wanted to wait until Memorial Day to really get a sense of how the polls are capturing the race. And because of the protests and all kinds of news that we've been covering, you have an extra 3.5 weeks, I think, past Memorial Day in order to get a sense of the state of the race. So now that these averages are out, now that we can be more precise, Mr. Silver, what's the state of the 2020 presidential election race?
Currently, if you were to have an election today, and there is not an election today, I want to be clear, it's in November, but if you were to have an election today, and the polls were even within the ballpark of accurate, then, conditional on those two things, Donald Trump would probably lose. Look, Trump is about as far behind as we've seen any candidate at any kind of point in the election for a number of cycles, right? I mean, 1996, Bill Clinton had some gargantuan leads over Bob Dole and won in a landslide. But, like, Clinton was never up 9 points. You got to 7 or 8 in our averages. Obama kind of peaked at 7 or 8. Bush and Kerry, maybe Bush was up by fairly wide margins at some points, but it was mostly a very, very close race. So this is on the verge right now of a landslide, but Trump has two things going for him, which are pretty obvious. One is that it's mid-June. There is plenty of time. Think how much news there is. This is ordinarily the... So when we say, okay, don't really look at the polls until Memorial Day, and then you can kind of take a peek at them, that doesn't mean they go from, like, deeply irrelevant to deeply meaningful. It means the start of meaning, there's a little bit of crack of daylight. You get a tiny bit in late May and early June and July, and then it kind of ramps up over time. It doesn't mean that you should, like, radically be altering how you feel about the country at this point. So there's plenty of time for Trump to come back. And the Electoral College, these swing states are, although we'll talk about this more, a bit closer than the national polls are. So de facto, it's probably more like a 6 or 7 point lead and not a 9 point lead.
Right, if you're looking at the actual battleground states. How predictive are general election polls 4.5 months out from Election Day? historically.
Not super predictive, right? They kind of go from, if you look at March, right, there's basically zero predictivity, and then by November there's pretty good predictivity, right? And so we're still kind of, I guess, closer to March than November.
Although we've heard arguments that more recently, because of polarization, and especially when you have two candidates with such high name recognition, that polls are even more predictive now than they would have been historically, where a candidate has to introduce themselves to the public and, you know, there are more maybe swing voters. Is that an argument that you buy?
Maybe. I mean, it's not a large sample size that we're looking at. Polls were also pretty volatile in 2016, which is the most recent example we have to go by. They've not been that volatile this year, but even so, right? Like, look, so if you roll back a month, we didn't publish these numbers, but we retroactively say what they would have been. So you go back to May 18th, that's a month ago, and Biden was up 5.5 points in our average. So 5.5 is potentially a competitive election, right?
In the Electoral College.
Yeah. If Trump has a 2 or 3 point edge in the Electoral College, then you're talking about, okay, maybe Biden's ahead 2 or 3 points in the tipping point state. And as we should know by now, a 2 or 3 point lead definitely is not terribly safe. So if you go in a month from 5.5 to 8.7, as we're recording this, right, there is absolutely no reason why in another month you couldn't go back to 5.5. And the month after that, you go back to 3, you know. So it just seems like premature to read too much into it. I mean, I don't know. Look, we kind of like this balance that we evolved first for the primaries, the now the general election, of like letting the averages kind of have their own run for a while without slapping probabilities on them too quickly.
Yeah. So this is something we're doing for the first time in a presidential election, publishing these polling averages separately. Why did you decide to do it this time around? Is it like to take the place of the Nowcast or what?
Good old Nowcast. The Nowcast has been canceled, Galen.
It has been canceled. Yes, I noticed.
No, like there are a couple of practical reasons why. One is just that like the model, I mean, we always kind of refresh it, right? And kind of half the work is in the polling averages part and half the work is everything else, basically. So if you're at the halfway point in your work and there's stuff that could be of interest to the public, then why not release it, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That's part of it. The other part, though, is that, like, look, this does let people have a couple different flavors of how they can use 538's resources. If you don't want all the fancy Electoral College modeling, if you don't really want to think too much about the probabilities, you just want, like, a very smart way to average what the polls say and to get kind of an updated state of the race in each state, and we have clever ways to update states that haven't been polled recently, then you can just kind of use this product as your main reference if you want. And it's relatively simple. It doesn't blend any other information with the polls. It doesn't try to make any assumptions about how states are correlated or not, right? It's just kind of reporting descriptively what the polls say, and you can kind of do with that information what you want. It's partly also to like decouple the polls and the forecast can be different. So for example, when you have a convention, a party will get a convention bounce in our model. We'll probably deduct some points from the party that just had its convention. The conventions can cause a temporary kind of sugar high for a party. But it still will be true. Like, let's say Biden gets some huge bounce. Maybe Biden's up 12, right? So our polling average will say Biden up 12. That will be an accurate reflection of what polls say at that moment. The best forecast of the race will probably not be Biden plus 12. It might be Biden plus 6 or something, or whatever he was before the convention. And so like, so that allows us to kind of remind people that like the polling average is an ingredient in the forecast. It's a major ingredient, but the forecast does other things on top of it. So it's probably kind of like the commitment to transparency, where you can either buy the finished product or you can buy some of the ingredients at our store and bake your own.
All right. Sounds good. So I want to get into some top line takeaways. I think a lot of people have noticed the differences between the polling average this year and in 2016, which is that this year Biden has been relatively steady at around 50% support in the national polls, whereas Hillary Clinton was up and down between the low 40s and the high 40s throughout the year, right? There's a lot more steadiness this year, and Biden is maintaining that level of steadiness at a higher point than Hillary Clinton was for most of 2016. what is that indicative of? Why is there more of a steady pace in the polls? And what does it mean that Biden's already at 50%?
So 50% is a pretty good number to be at. There used to be this kind of myth that if you're the incumbent and you're below 50%, then you're in trouble. And that's not really true empirically. It is true, though, that when the challenger is at 50%, then you have quite a few problems, because even if you are to gain ground, right, from undecided voters, then at best you can do is tie. Now, of course, people can change their minds. It's not like people kind of go into one lane and stay there necessarily. But there's not necessarily a ton of vote switching, especially in a very partisan time in the country's history. And so, you know, so Trump either has to persuade some voters that thought they backed Biden that they're not going to, hope those Biden voters don't turn out, or win the Electoral College. It's actually still like a fairly full menu of options. But none of them are as easy as just being ahead in the first place or only needing some undecided voters to come to you to win.
Yeah. And the other, I think, important takeaway here right off the top is probably the difference between the national polling average and the averages in some of the key battleground states, where you see in the Rust Belt, for example, Biden leading by 5 to 7 points, and nationally, Biden leading by 9 points. So is it safe to say at this point that Biden would need to win by at least like 3 or 4 points nationally in order to win the Electoral College? Can we get that specific yet?
No, definitely not. And in fact, it might be a little bit less than that. I mean, there are a lot of states that are closely packed together. I think technically like the tipping point state right now is Minnesota, which is 2 or 3 points behind the national polls. There hasn't been much polling, though, in Minnesota. There's not been much polling recently in Pennsylvania, a state where actually Biden has not polled that well. But if that were to have some new polls that were better for Biden, that could affect the order a bit. Part of the complication here is that like there is some utility to Biden in having multiple paths. If there are a bunch of states that are grouped together that are 3 points more Republican than national polls, they probably won't all be 3 points more Republican than national polls when the voting actually takes place. There'll be a surprise in one direction in one state, a surprise in another direction in the other state. Things can change. Things can shift a little bit. So I think it's likely to say that Trump has Electoral College advantage. Whether that's 1 point or 5 points, I think we just don't have enough robust enough polling, right? To be that precise, you would need like 4 or 5 recent polls in all the swing states. We only have that in some of the swing states, right? And B, even no matter how much polling you have, polls can be off or they can change. So it's a little early to say anything beyond that, like, that Trump has an Electoral College advantage. It looks like somewhere on the magnitude of where it was in 2016.
And Hillary Clinton won the national vote by 2 percentage points. So that was about the split in 2016, right? Two points.
More like 3 points, because she actually lost a tipping point state, Wisconsin, by like 0.8 points or something, right? So it's a 3 point spread in total.
Got it. Okay. So that's our baseline for maybe judging how that divide between the Electoral College and the national vote margin goes in 2020. So to get a little bit wonky here, let's talk about what goes into these polling averages, because there are other polling averages out there. So essentially, what makes 538 different, and why do we think we do it, you know, better, I guess we can say. So what goes into these?
Well, they're made up of polls. We use almost every poll. There are some weird cases of things that we're not sure whether they're actually polls or not. There are a couple of pollsters that like literally are fake every year that we try to detect that before we include kind of literally people making stuff up, often like people on betting markets, Scottish teens making up numbers. But yeah, we weight the polls based on their sample size and their pollster rating. So the pollster rating also reflects how accurate they've been historically, plus whether they abide by certain industry best practices methodologically. We have different methods of how you like literally average them together. One is kind of a real clear politics method where you take a moving average, and one is more like a pollster.com. Shout out. Let's pour one out for the now defunct pollster.com. where you draw some type of polynomial trend line over the average. Basically blend those two methods together. When you get closer to November, then we rely more on the curve method, which the way we do it anyway is more aggressive. So you want to be more conservative early in the race and a bit more aggressive later on because movement tends to stick. You know, if there's a temporary shift that happens on November 2nd, well, that's just going to affect the outcome, whether you like it or not, Galen.
So part of the weighting process here is looking at our pollster ratings. And we did actually just publish new pollster ratings for 2020. So I guess we can also judge at this point, how are polls performing? Were there any significant changes in the well-known pollsters or lesser-known pollsters that we should take note of going into 2020?
Not particularly. I mean, at this point, we have pollster ratings dating back to 1998, although recent data is weighted more heavily. So one cycle tends not to affect things, really half a cycle, right? Not all of 2020, but just the presidential primary cycle is what we had in this update. Tends not to affect things that much, except for pollsters that are new and we're kind of doing a lot of polling for the first time. There were some new, kind of more prolific pollsters in the primaries that, for example, put out a bunch of polls around Super Tuesday states. The results of those, if we're being super honest, was pretty mixed. Data for Progress was a group that did relatively well, although had some misses with the race shifting quite a lot, frankly, before Super Tuesday. There were other people in that group that like tried to pull over Super Tuesday state and like just were not very good, honestly. I mean, the primaries are kind of rough. The primaries are low turnout affairs and things change a lot. The priors can't be weighted as much, and so primaries are hard. But no, I mean, the pollster ratings themselves were not that necessarily shocking. Although, you know, we still, by the way, do think that, like, you know, every year we kind of wait and say, okay, when's the year that online polls are going to be as accurate as traditional telephone polls that call cell phones? And every year, kind of, they aren't, right? They still have a little bit of catching up to do. And so our pollster ratings still give a higher grade, other things being equal, to pollsters that are live caller polls with cell phones.
Mm-hmm. So on the general question of polling quality, we got a lot of questions about an article that Politico recently published that said, quote, "Some pollsters are still grappling with the same problems that plagued battleground state surveys 4 years ago." And then they went on to specify that not enough surveys are being conducted in the battleground states, and that those that exist are failing to account for non-college educated whites growing more Republican and college educated whites growing more Democratic, as we've talked about plenty on this podcast. So I don't know if you read that article, but is Politico right? Is the polling world still facing some of the challenges that it was back in 2016 on the state level in battleground states?
So I kind of have like a macro take on this, right? Which is that in politics, including polling analysis, people are like often fighting the last war. And also like just the incentives are probably like you can't be too careful about dismissing Trump's chances. And so in general, like just from a meta point of view, I would guess the journalism around polling and selection will be very cautious, maybe more cautious than if you're purely just kind of making a bet on this, right? You kind of didn't really care about like reputationally, how you're covering your ass, right? If you're just kind of like, you know what, we're all super rational here, we're just going to make a forecast, right? So, you know, that makes me like a little bit suspicious of some of it. With that said, you know, I think clearly pollsters should be weighting by education. I think those that are not should have a good reason why they're not doing it. Maybe there are other ways you can kind of eliminate the effects of the sample being maybe biased in certain ways. But like, it's not like, you know, look at what's happening in the country. You know, it's like unemployment is, what's unemployment? Like 13%, it fell, right?
We've had
a pandemic that's killed about 110,000 people and counting, and we may only be halfway through it or less. We have historic protests, and Trump's handling of race relations is maybe his biggest single negative, right? The president was impeached. I'm not sure if that helps him or hurts him, but like the president was impeached, although not removed from office earlier this year, right? Is it inherently that hard to believe that Joe Biden could be ahead by 8 or 9 points, given all of that? I don't think it should be that hard to believe.
Right. I guess that's when you look at the polling average nationally, and the polling average nationally in 2016 was not far off from the end result, closer than 2012. But I think the concerns here are, is there still just not enough polling in battleground states? And the polling that does exist, is it waiting for education? And so, I mean, looking at what we have so far, does it seem like there's robust polling in battleground states? And are you seeing any high-quality, respectable pollsters that are still not waiting by education?
I don't care that much, because I'm not trying to play poll police.
Okay.
I'm trying to look at this in a macro way, right?
Yeah.
What usually happens after a polling miss is that some pollsters stubbornly go on and keep doing what they were doing before and make the same mistake twice. And other pollsters overcompensate. They're like, we really do not want to underestimate Trump again, so we're going to push every lever that we can to push things away from Biden, right, and be doubly and triply sure, including some levers that were actually fine, and now you've introduced bias by introducing some dumb ad hoc method, right? This actually happened in the most recent UK general election, the penultimate UK general election, where there have been a lot of years where polls had overrated Labour, and so pollsters did some extremely, frankly, just hackish things, putting a really, really, really blatant thumb on the scale, maybe a whole fist, to do every adjustment they could toward shift things back toward conservatives. And lo and behold, Theresa May did much worse than polls predicted, right?
Right. I mean, are you seeing that happen in American polling right now, that you think some like high quality pollsters are overcompensating for 2016?
I think the incentives are there to overcompensate, right? Mm-hmm. The incentives are there to like, first of all, people are biased in how they perceive reality, right? And they have incentives, and like, people have a real problem with making the same mistake twice in a row. And the problem with elections is like, they only happen every 4 years. So if you have an election, you kind of dwell on that for 4 years and get all the haranguing media articles, right? And the scolding tone and whatever. And so, you know, unless people are very kind of self-possessed, then they're going to kind of succumb to like some of that pressure. Now, on the flip side of that, also some people are very stubborn, right? And some people will say, well, the national polls were okay, and maybe things shifted at the last minute, and they'll make excuses, right? And they won't shift enough. I'm just saying, like, empirically, those two very human tendencies tend to balance out a fair bit. And so what happens is, if you take the average of polls, then the bias is not predictable from cycle to cycle. You know, empirically, about one-third of the time, the polls are very close, and one-third of the time, they're kind of biased in each of the other directions, right? And people have a pretty terrible track record when they try to guess, this is the year that Trump will be biased, that polls will be biased toward Democrats or against Democrats or whatever else, right?
But you still think, regardless of all of that, the worries about overcompensation, that pollsters should be waiting for education, or at least trying to figure out another way to compensate for the fact that people with lower levels of education are not polled as frequently or do not respond to pollsters as frequently as people with higher levels of education.
Pollsters should be making continuous improvement in many areas. One of the reasons you could get this overcompensation effect is because pollsters will only examine sources of error that underrated Trump and not those that maybe underrated Democrats. So Clinton actually beat her polls in like 8 or 10 states in 2016. These were mostly Western states where you have high number of Hispanic voters. That could be part of it, right? Like, so Nevada and Arizona, California, which has big consequences for the popular vote, for example. Texas is a state where Democrats have actually done as well or better than their polls. Like Beto O'Rourke.
Mm-hmm. He won by negative 2 points. Is that?
He won. Beto O'Rourke won by negative 2 points, but he was supposed to win by -4. So Beto did a little bit better, Beto-er, than the poll suggested. Okay. So I would also be worried about, okay, well, am I getting enough non-white, particularly Hispanic voters in states where they are plentiful, and or maybe where the electorate is changing a lot? Maybe my likely voter model is excluding too many people who were newly registered Democrats and now will vote when they hadn't before.
So there are lots of factors to consider, and education is one of them that has been heavily scrutinized over the past 4 years.
That's right. There are lots of different sources of error in polling. I think the singular focus on education weighting, although that might be the single most important thing, you still have to also look for other sources of error. Are you getting enough Latino respondents? Are you getting enough older respondents if you have a poll that is done online with very, very high turnout potentially? We had very high turnout in 2018, for example. Are you screening out too many unlikely voters who will vote this year? And that could kind of cut in both ways in both parties in different states. So, yeah, I do find like the singular obsessiveness over education weighting to be a little disproportionate. But I think there shouldn't be much debate that pollsters are getting samples that are too educated, that that tends to help Democrats, and that if they don't do anything about it, of which education weighting is the most obvious way, maybe not the only way, then you're going to have problems.
Got it. All right. So let's get to some listener questions. And I'll say up front that we got a lot of questions. We're definitely not going to get to all of them in this podcast, but we have 4.5 months to answer them all. So don't worry, we will get to them eventually. So our first question out of the gate is Texas actually a swing state? So if you look at our state-level polling averages, Biden is behind by, I think, less than a point in Texas currently. And in the write-up that you did, Nate, you included Texas in your write-up of the swing state. So it looks like you were considering Texas to be a swing state. Should we consider Texas a swing state now?
Galen, I think we should consider Texas a competitive state. People mean different things by the term swing state, right? The 538 concept that we're most fond of is called tipping point states, which is a state that can change the balance of the election. That if you line up all states from most Democratic to most Republican, a tipping point state is the one that gives a candidate his or her 270th electoral vote and therefore is decisive. If Biden is up 9 nationally and Texas is tied or he's down 1, then Texas will probably not be the tipping point state. However, if he's only down 1, it means he could win it, obviously, pretty easily. It's not a toss-up quite, but like obviously it's competitive. So it's a swing state. I think the one thing we've seen in this recent polling slump for Trump is it actually does seem to be a little bit more concentrated among certain groups. So it seems to be more concentrated among older voters. So Texas is a pretty young state, whereas like Florida, for example, is an older state. That's a state where Biden has made big gains in some polls. It actually seems to be maybe a little bit among white working class voters, like white working class women in particular, which, you know, maybe isn't as much of Texas, really, which is actually a pretty college educated state. Trump actually is holding his own decently well among Hispanics. I think our friend of the pod, former podcaster Harry Enten, has talked about that a little bit.
And that he's increased his margins with Hispanic voters, right?
I am skeptical there's been an increase, but I think those numbers have held up relatively well compared to other groups with which he's lost ground. So relatively speaking, he's doing better. So, you know, none of those are great characteristics for Texas. If you want to win Texas as a Democrat, it means other states shift toward the tipping point where Texas is steady or shifts away from it a little bit. So I think Texas looks a little bit less important than it might have a few months ago. With that said, it's so many electoral votes. Polling is a little bit of an adventure there because the state is changing and because it used to be very low turnout, but maybe now turnout is higher. It is a state where Democrats have overperformed the polls a little bit. So, you know, we'll see what our tipping point analysis says when we actually launch the model. But yeah.
All right. Next question we have is from Martin, who says, it seems like Pennsylvania hasn't swung as much as other similar states like Michigan, Wisconsin, or Ohio. Any ideas why? And by the swing that Martin is talking about is the swing towards Biden over the past month.
Yeah, I think that level of precision, we may not have enough polling to do right now, right? There are not a lot of high quality polls in Pennsylvania recently. So if someone were to weigh in Pennsylvania, that could shift things potentially a fair bit, just a single poll or two. Trump got in a feud with Governor Gretchen Whitmer of Michigan. She seemed to be on the more popular side of that in Wisconsin, You know, there were also disputes over stay-at-home orders and the cancellation of those by the Supreme Court, which is very kind of conservative there. So maybe liberals are up in arms about that in Wisconsin. I mean, I don't know, right? You can kind of tell these stories. I think it's probably noise. You know, Biden is kind of partly from Pennsylvania. Pennsylvania is actually like a bit more urban and racially mixed than Wisconsin or Michigan. Biden is doing kind of surprisingly well in polls of Ohio, where I think we have him ahead in Ohio in our polling average. So it's just a little weird that Pennsylvania hasn't kind of followed the trend of others say. It's also the polling in Michigan, by the way, has historically not been very good, right? So I kind of think if the polls say Biden's up 10 in Michigan and 5 in Pennsylvania, well, is he really ahead 7 in each one? That might be very, very possible.
Next question, I don't know if you've looked into this, but it was, has COVID-19 changed polling response patterns? And I think the implication here was people are, in many cases, staying at home or working from home. Are they more likely to answer their phone in that case?
Maybe, I guess. Yeah, it's probably good for the polling industry. People are at home all the freaking time right now. I think there may also, the flip side of this, though, is that like there are some call centers where actually one of the things you probably don't want to do is go into an enclosed workspace where a lot of people are talking loudly. There was a super spreader event in South Korea associated with a call center. I don't know. We should do some more reporting on this. I would imagine that a lot of pollsters now have their people working from home and calling people from home. There are a couple of pollsters that I think only had an actual physical call center and did not have that technology set up that temporarily shifted polls online. But yeah, maybe one of the, Galen, the silver lining of coronavirus is higher response
more
rates to polls.
So the next question comes from Tracy, and this gets at something that we discussed a little bit on the podcast on Monday. The question is, what data do we have on whether there are some Republicans who are no longer identifying as Republicans? So I guess former Republicans who are now identifying as independents or Democrats. And this dovetails off of the discussion we had on Monday about, you know, there was only 25% Republicans in a particular CNN poll that we were looking at. So is there any evidence that the number of people identifying as Republicans is on the decline in the U.S.?
Yeah, look, there can be some shifts. They tend to be a little bit more slow. But if people are really, I mean, the GOP has been the party of Donald Trump now for a period of 4 years, basically. And, you know, people may have lost their historic loyalty to like the George Bush GOP or the Richard Nixon GOP or whatever else, the Reagan GOP, of course. So that identity can change. You know, in general, younger voters of all political persuasions tend not to want to identify with either party. They tend to want to be independents, even if they are very liberal or conservative. They may say, I'm on the left, but I'm not a Democrat, right? That was part of Bernie Sanders' appeal to voters who didn't like the capital D Democratic label, even though they may have been on board with either Bernie's platform or another Democrat's platform. So it wouldn't be surprising if support for Republicans overall erodes. And it's, you know, does it move as fast as preference in the ballot in Biden versus Trump preferences? No, usually what happens is that you would sooner shift from Biden to Trump or Trump to Biden than you would shift parties. And that shifting parties is like a more dramatic step. But some people kind of switch both at once and their party allegiance shifts depending on the day and depending on news events. And that's kind of why assuming that party identification is fixed is, in my view, like kind of against the whole nature of polling, where one of the things you want to poll is like, what party do people affiliate with? Now, if you want to get technical here, if you have like party registration, that is a fixed characteristic, at least in some states, although some states don't have party registration, right? You can go and look up in some states what someone's registered as, and that is an absolute thing, right? But most polls just say, do you generally consider yourself a Democrat or Republican, an independent, or something else? And that is an attitudinal question.
Yeah. So next question, which you got at a little bit in talking about Texas, but it is, where is Biden underperforming? How bad is his deficit with Hispanic voters vis-a-vis Clinton 2016? And in which states could that have the biggest impact? So we can talk about the Hispanic voters portion of that, but just broadly, where is Biden underperforming compared with, I guess, national polls?
Well, look, I mean, the tipping point states are a bit closer than national polls. In general, Clinton won by 2 in the popular vote, and Biden's ahead by 9. So in general, Biden is doing better kind of across the board. In some ways, maybe he's not getting actually quite as much of a boost in some of the more newfangled states than you would think, right? Like, you know, he is like tied, roughly speaking, in Georgia right now, for example. So his map looks a little bit more like the, and you would think that Georgia, all the discussion over Georgia, you might think that, well, it's maybe not a tipping point state, but if he's ahead 9 points, he should be ahead in Georgia, and he's maybe ahead half a point or, right? So I think it's looked a little bit more like the Obama 2012 map, or maybe the Obama 2012 map with Arizona included potentially, and a bit less like the Clinton map, which in some ways is good for Democrats. Because the Obama 2012 map was like configured in a better way for them in the Electoral College. One thing you are seeing, though, is like some of these states that are more college educated and that once were swing states are just completely far gone now for Republicans, right? Like Colorado, Biden is like up 16 points or something in some polls, right? And I remember when it was a novelty when the Democratic Party held its convention in Denver in 2008, and it was a big deal that Colorado is now purple. I mean, Colorado is now pretty blue. Virginia is now pretty blue, those two in particular. You know, California, who knows, Biden could win by 30 points or something, right? You know, New Jersey is a state that people used to pretend was competitive and just isn't anymore. So there's a chance that, like, I mean, here's what's a little tricky about the Electoral College is, like, how to put this. It's not necessarily an Electoral College weakness per se if Biden really runs up the score in really blue states. You know what I mean? It's not bad for Biden that he wins California by 32 instead of 25 or something. It does mean that maybe national polls are like less indicative of what's happening in the swing states. But it's not quite like Clinton in 2016 where, like, I mean, she just lost a lot of places, right? She just wasn't that strong a candidate in a lot of states. Am I making sense, Galen?
Right. Like, if you mimic Barack Obama's map in 2012, but then get a bunch more votes in already blue states, it's not a bad thing for you per se. It will exacerbate the divide between the national polls and the Electoral College. But it's not like you've lost a whole bunch of ground that you used to have in the process of it. Is that what you're saying?
And that's what Biden's map looks like, more or less, right? It looks like Obama's 2012 map with some supercharged margins in a few states, many of which don't actually help in the Electoral College. Arizona maybe being the important exception. But Obama had a robust Electoral College map in 2012, and like Biden right now is doing better than Obama. I think he's doing worse in Iowa, but basically equal to or better than Obama in all the other states.
I mean, the other thing to keep in mind here about the Electoral College is it can turn something that is a sizable national lead all of a sudden into a complete landslide, right? Like, if Biden is winning Texas, then we're no longer talking about a Trump advantage in the Electoral College, because Biden's advantage in the Electoral College at that point way outpaces, you know, a 10-point national lead.
Yeah, look, I mean, this could totally be some very large margins, right? If Biden won every state on kind of our swing state list, including Texas and Iowa, he would win more than 400 electoral votes. So yeah, there is definitely like the potential for a big landslide, although I would say like probably not a 1984 style landslide where Reagan won. It's the first election I remember, Galen. I remember Walter Mondale winning D.C. and Minnesota. You know, a little sad for good old Walt right there. We're not going to see that in this type of partisan environment where, you know, even with a fairly broad swing state map this year, there are still some states that are completely off limits. And kind of once you get kind of past Iowa, there's not like an obvious list of additional states that Biden could win. Maybe Utah, if you're being extremely creative. If Mitt Romney endorses Biden, actually, it could be interesting. So you're not going to see an 84 style landslide in this political environment. But right now, if you had the election today, then Biden could win 400 plus electoral votes. He couldn't win 450. He could win 400 something, though, low 400s. And that's, you know, that would get people's attention. But the flip side of this is like, things don't have to shift that much for Trump to kind of recreate a winning electoral college map. You know what I mean? A 4 or 5 point shift net between now and November would make things very interesting. And like people who don't think there can't be a 4 or 5 point shift have not paid any attention to polling. I mean, that's not that big a shift over all the time we have left.
All right. Well, I think that's a good place to leave things. So we will come back to this in the future. Thank you to everyone who sent in their questions. If you have any questions, you can send them on Twitter or to podcasts@538.com. But that's it for now. Thanks, Nate.
Thank you, Galen.
My name is Galen Druk. Tony Chow is in the virtual control room. You can get in touch by emailing us at podcasts@538.com. You can also, of course, tweet at us with questions or comments. If you're a fan of the show, leave us a rating or review in the Apple Podcast Store or tell someone about us. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you soon.